In the book of Job, we'll read now the first two chapters. The book of Job, which you find before the Psalter, the first two chapters. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Now, before we consider Job this evening, we must get that into our minds, what we've just read in this first verse. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord. This is not on the earth, of course, but in the heavenly places, the place of heavenly conflict. The angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and there were different sorts of angels here, as you'll see, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." Notice, that has been said of him before, but now it is the Lord who is saying this of Job. Has the Lord ever said as much about any other man but his son? "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands, so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby when the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." And while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they are dead, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" And Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going to and fro in it." Notice the restlessness of evil. The restlessness of evil. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, and a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones." As if God would ever do such a thing to his own child and servant. "And he will surely cuss you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery, a shard, and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." He replied, "You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble or evil?" In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. When Job's three friends, the word friend should be in quotes, shouldn't it? Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him, because they saw how great his suffering was. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. Now some lessons from the book of Job. We will not go on into the second half of Paul's letter to the Romans now, and instead of dealing directly, as I would have liked to have done, with the third dimension of evil as it commonly afflicts Christians, with strong emphasis on the warfare passage in Ephesians 6, I thought we might tackle the same subject of the third dimension of evil, the kingdom of evil itself, beyond sins and sin, through the Old Testament for a change, by looking again at the book of Job, not exactly running right through it, but selecting passages for consideration of its prime message, the exposure of Satan, which is not much acknowledged, one must admit, and less understood even by preachers and teachers.
Yet all is made clear in the first two chapters, if we would see the significance. There you have a drama wrought out on a theater with a two-level stage, such as you find in the last act of Verdi's Aida. You have the level of the conflict between good and evil in the heavenly places, and then on the lower level you have the effects of that conflict of angels on the life of Job on earth. Indeed, we marvel that with the conflict in the heavenlies as it is, it was possible for such a righteous man as Job to enjoy prosperity so long without satanic interference. It was of God, of course, who had put a hedge around him. But when Satan was at last permitted by God to attack Job, the devil spared him not at all, up to the very limit that the Lord had imposed upon the devil. There was scarcely ever such suffering recorded, perhaps only in the case of our blessed Lord himself, of whom Job in some ways may be regarded as a type. You see, from our reading of chapters 1 and 2, Job and his wonderful integrity, with his great prosperity, and the two do not often go together in life's experience, although we must not be cynical enough to discount God having his rich men for his purposes. We have known them in our own times, who have regarded their wealth as a stewardship from God. But you only need to read through Job chapter 29 and chapter 31 to see what a wonderfully upright character Job was, and how full of grace and compassion his life was. But of course, that is vouched for already by the Lord in Job chapter 1, verse 8, and in Job chapter 2, verse 3, as we have read. Such a man, of course, was a perfect target for Satan, and one could imagine Satan straining at the leash to get at this man as soon as the Lord removed the hedge from him. And it may have been that the tempter had been eyeing him for a long time, wishing that God would remove his protecting hedge from around him, as we read of in chapter 1, verse 10, so that the devil, you see, could get his dirty paws on him. I say paws because of the revelation of Satan under the figure of two animal monsters, which we have later on in Job, chapters 40, 15 and following, Behemoth, and Job chapter 41, 1 to 34, Leviathan, which I believe are types of the devil whom God controls. We'll not get as far as that tonight, but note it. In the end, of course, the Almighty determined to expose Job somewhat to Satan and allow him to be tried in ways that were shatteringly new to the dear man. Nonetheless, you see that Satan is limited, as always, in his testing of Job, which reminds us of that great, albeit sometimes incomprehensible word in 1 Corinthians 10. There, Paul had been reminding the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 10, that God allowed things to happen to the Old Testament saints for our learning, for our learning. And we read in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. That's because Christ has come. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. Well then, in the first instance, as we read, Job is to lose all that he has lived for in his righteously prosperous life. Lose everything except his wife, who turns out in the event, and he may not have known this until then, to be a doubtful blessing to him as far as withstanding testing is concerned. No help at all. However, Job's wife seems not to have interfered with him at the first test in the first chapter, that of losing all his family and his wealth, although the poor woman must have been devastated as Job was at the tremendous loss. Yet he himself kept his integrity, as we read, of course, in the first chapter, the 20th verse. He got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." But it was after a second council of war in heaven, when Satan was allowed to go much farther and cut much more deeply into Job's own personal experience, that Mrs. Job protested and would have wanted to be rid of her poor man and of his God, who had done, as she presumably supposed, such a terrible thing to her, Job. As to that, one of the most valued monitors of my youth had a wife whose zeal knew no bounds for the Lord, until the Lord took her husband from her, and she collapsed, and all the carnality and hidden ungodliness of her character were revealed, to the astonishment of many, including her own family. When we lean hard on another, we may not know how much faith we have ourselves, or whether it is real faith at all. There's a word, surely, to some. "No," said Job to his irate wife, "I will not curse God and die. You speak like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not evil, not trouble?" But you see, at this point there is no word of Satan. And this was the cause of Job's honest ignorance, you see, which cost him so much mental and spiritual anguish to add to his physical tortures, because his world had been ruled by a universally benevolent God in whom he trusted and who had blessed him with godly prosperity, an unusual thing. But in dear Job there is no understanding of evil at all. To Job, if I can put it like this, you'll not misunderstand. To Job, God had no problem. And that, of course, made for a dangerously vulnerable world. For God had a problem, and has a problem, which, of course, you would expect me to say, he has proved to be perfectly capable of coping with more than supreme adequacy. He has dealt with his problem supremely, wonderfully. But you see, naive and ignorant men may not understand the humble and patient way that God deals with his problem of evil.
Job did not understand, and so, in his ignorance of the foe of God and man, he attributed all evil as well as all good directly to God. Do you see that? Of course, all evil is certainly under the sovereign control of the Almighty, but sin and evil are nevertheless disastrous interpositions which God, for his higher purposes, is willing to cope with and deal with in his own wise and inscrutable way. So, to remind us of the position of Job and the truth of God's word and his will, we need to read yet once more our two short paragraphs from the Confession of Faith, which state the position of the Almighty in relation to sin and evil. Listen. God from all eternity did, by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will, freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass, good and evil. Yet, so as thereby neither is God the author of sin, notice the next part, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. Free will is established by the sovereignty of God. Think of that. My, how many hours could we argue on that? Here's the other paragraph, chapter 5, paragraph 4 of Providence. The almighty power, unsearchable wisdom, and infinite goodness of God so far manifest themselves in his providence that it extends itself even to the first fall and all other sins of angels and men, and it extends itself not by a bare permission, but such as has joined with it a most wise and powerful bounding and otherwise ordering and governing of sins in a manifold dispensation to God's holy ends, yet so as the sinfulness thereof proceeds only from the creature, God cannot sin, and not from God, who, being most holy and righteous, neither is nor can be the author or the approver of sin. So Job, in his ignorance of what was happening to him when his own body was touched, which was quite a different thing from evil touching his family and his wealth, Job, in his ignorance of what was happening to him, let out in chapter 3 an unearthly yell, and demanded of God that he die forthwith. In fact, although it would never have entered his heart or his mind to curse God, as his wife had suggested, die is exactly what he wanted to do. And we might add, who would not in his circumstances want to die and be delivered from the misery of such an excruciating existence? Which situation was not helped, of course, by the appearance of his so-called friends, who obviously saw his affliction, although they waited 7 days to say so, saw his affliction as a judgment from God. I suppose it was this above all that made the man want to die, that the friends would have made him believe that his affliction was a judgment from God, when all the time, as our first two chapters make so plain, it was not a judgment from God, because the man Job was the most righteous man on the face of the earth in his day, which, as we have said before, is proved by the testimony
which I hope you will read perhaps the night before you sleep in chapters 29 and 31. Then comes Job's heart cry for oblivion. Blot him out. He wishes he'd never been born. And it's a moving document. Let me read chapter 3 with you now. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said, a boy is born, that day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day. Those who are ready to rouse Leviathan, may its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of the dawn, for it did not shut the doors of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built for themselves places now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Oh, why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives also enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave driver's shout. The small and the great are there, and the slave is freed from his master. Why is light given to those in misery, and life to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded, this is significant. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil. And for answer, the first of Job's three so-called friends, Eliphaz, says, "You sound the very acme of injured innocence," 4 and 7. "But if you had had my experience," says Eliphaz, "you would know how little God trusts men." And so Eliphaz tells Job of his nightmare dream, which Eliphaz obviously thought was from God. Let's read a little of that. Chapter 4, verse 12, Eliphaz's nightmare. He says, "A word was secretly brought to me. My ears caught a whisper of it amid disquieting dreams in the night. When deep sleep falls on men, fear and trembling seized me and made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face, and the hair on my body stood on end. It stopped, but I could not tell what it was." Notice, I could not tell what it was. "A form stood before my eyes, and I heard a hushed voice." This is what it said. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If God places no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth? Between dawn and dusk they are broken to pieces, and notice they perish forever. Are not the cords of their tents pulled up so that they die without wisdom? And Eliphaz, you see, goes on in chapter 5 to say that since Job is obviously a secret sinner and a backslider, there is only one thing for him to do, and that is to turn to God and repent. But you see, we know that that would have been entirely wrong as far as Job was concerned. For you see, Eliphaz experienced was not a visitation from God. This is not God's word, that mortal man can never be righteous before God. That's not the gospel. That's not the truth, even of the Old Testament. What Eliphaz had had was a satanic visitant. But he thought it was God. A visitant from Satan who sounded the very soul of piety, as Satan loves to do, the angel of light, and loves to set the standard of human morality impossibly high for man, anything to hurt man, anything to make man feel bad. God, he said, who cannot trust his angels, is quite contemptuous of man. Man made of clay. And the only way that God would ever hear Job is if he groveled. And so in chapter 6, Job accordingly grovels. For, says Eliphaz, God is angry with you. So Job says, if only God would let me die. Look at the 8th verse of chapter 6. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have this consolation, my joy in unrelenting pain, that I had not denied the words of the Holy One. You see the dear man's dilemma. Then the poor man simply wails pathetically and reproaches those who should have been his friends, not his accusers. And we ask ourselves, what do these charges do to a despairing man? Do they think that a man like Job will tell lies in the throes of such agony as he is suffering? Would he lie then? No, and in chapter 7, Job begins to grope for and glimmer after a deeper understanding of his trouble. He does turn to God, but not specifically as a sinner and backslider. After all, a man can't confess sins he is not guilty of to please others. Poor my cock. To please others who are utterly ignorant as to the cause of his condition and think he is suffering for his sins when he is really suffering for his righteousness. But he does cry out. And notice, Job also has demonic nightmares. Chapter 7, verse 14, where he says, even then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions. Job also is deceived about this, you see, and longs for death. What is man, he says, at the 17th verse there, what is man? And he speaks this along with the psalmist of the 8th psalm, you remember, and one makes one wonder which passage, either this passage of Job chapter 7
or Psalm 8 is derived from one another. And he goes on in a passage of infinite bewilderment from that 17th verse of chapter 7 to say, what is man that you make so much of him, that you give him so much attention, that you examine him every morning and test him every moment? Will you never look away from me or let me alone even for an instant? If I have sinned, says Job to the Lord, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you made me your target? Have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my offenses and forgive my sins? He says to this God who is tormenting him, for I shall soon lie down in the dust. You will search for me, but I shall be no more, he says. But you see, Job has asked the right question. What is man? And that's important. And then Bildad, the second friend, then speaks in chapter 8. But he adds nothing to the argument, only alleging that Job is full of long, windy words. But he is a little kinder than the first man. Yet speaks of justice, but not of mercy. He advises Job to humble himself and to learn. This is painful enough. To humble himself and learn from previous history that the wicked do not prosper. How sore that must have been to the dear man whom God honors so highly. Then Job in chapter 9 says, yes, God is great. And how can a mortal man be righteous before God? How can I dispute with him? For even if I were innocent, he says, I could not answer him, but only plead for mercy. And one gains the impression that as these so-called friends go on with their penetrating accusations, Job's impression of the God he thinks is afflicting him is of one who is exceedingly ruthless. This is a new God to Job. And he becomes increasingly bewildered. Look at the 9th chapter and the 15th verse. He says, 9 and 15, though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with my judge for mercy. Even if I summoned him and he responded, I do not believe he would give me a hearing. He would crush me with a storm and multiply my wounds for no reason. Now, Job never thought this of God before, but in his present experience, this is what he thinks. He would crush me with a storm and multiply my wounds for no reason. He would not let me regain my breath, but would overwhelm me with misery. If it is a matter of strength, he is mighty. And if it is a matter of justice, who will summon him? Even if I were innocent, he says again, my mouth would condemn me. If I were blameless, it would pronounce me guilty. You see? Although I am blameless. Oh, you've had that experience, haven't you? Of course you have. This is absolutely up to date and in perfect accord with human psychology as we know it. Although I am blameless, he says, I have no concern for myself. I despise my own life. It's all the same. That is why I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked, this monster God. When a scourge brings sudden death, he mocks the despair of the innocent. When a land falls into the hands of the wicked, he blindfolds its judges. That's the devil, of course, isn't it? But he thinks it's God. If it is not, and this is the interesting thing. Notice how he begins to penetrate. If it is not he, if it is not God, then who is it? This, I think, is the text of Robert What's-His-Name's article that he has written about Satan. Give me his name. Robert Fyle, yes, who has written a scholarly article in this very subject. That's right. And this is what he takes as a text. If it is not he, if it is not God, who in the world is it? Well, of course, it's the devil, but Job doesn't know that. Do you see the point?
My days, he says, are swifter than a runner. They fly away with a glimpse of joy. They skim past like boats of papyrus, like eagles sweeping down on their prey. If I say I will forget my complaint, I will change my expression and smile, I still dread all my sufferings, for I know you will not hold me innocent. Since I am already found guilty, why should I struggle in vain? Even if I wash soap and my hands with washing soda, you would plunge me into a slime pit so that even my clothes would detest me. And then this. He is not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there were, see him feeling after Christ. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, a mediator, to lay his hand upon us both, someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more, then I would speak up without fear of him. But as it now stands with me, I cannot. And he goes on, I loathe my very life, therefore I will give free rein to my complaint and speak out in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me, but tell me what charges you have against me. Does it please you to oppress me, to spurn the work of your hands, while you smile on the schemes of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you see as a mortal sees? Are your days like those of a mortal, or your years like those of a man, that you must search out my faults and probe after my sin? Though you know that I am not guilty and that no one can rescue me from your hand, your hands shaped me and made me, will you now turn and destroy me? Remember that you molded me like clay. Will you now turn me to dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese, clothe me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews? You gave me life and showed me kindness, and in your providence watched over my spirit. But this is what you concealed in your heart, and I know that this was in your mind. If I sinned, you would be watching me and would not let my offense go unpunished. If I am guilty, woe to me. Even if I am innocent, I cannot lift up my head, for I am full of shame and drowned in my affliction. If I hold my head high, you stalk me like a lion and again display your awesome power against me. You bring new witnesses against me, his friends, and increase your anger toward me. Your forces come against me wave upon wave. Why then did you bring me out of the womb? I wish I had died before any eye saw me. If only I had never come into being, or had been carried straight from the womb to the grave. Are not my few days almost over? Turn away from me so I can have a moment's joy before I go to the place of no return, to the land of gloom and deep shadow, in the land of deepest night, of deep shadow and disorder, where even the light is like darkness. You see, the dear man's appalling dilemma and distress, what can he do when the God who had blessed him so richly and so long has now turned to be his enemy and has sent these friends, to rub it all into him as hard as they can? And yet God won't tell him his fault and his sin. Now, this is a common experience with those who are falsely accused by the enemy of God and man, Satan, the accuser of the brethren, as John calls him in Revelation 12 and 10. He envelops the accused in a fog of condemnation with the most terrible feelings of guilt, although he will not put his finger on the spot. Oh, notice this about Satan. The implication is that the accused is a whole mass depths of corruption and guilt, and is so bad that no point-by-point account would avail. He is so very bad. And we should be aware of this specious tactic of the enemy and its plausible flood of charges and accusations. Because, you see, the real God is so different from that. He is always kindly specific and puts his finger gently and kindly on the spot and says in such a loving, although perhaps it may be a sad and wistful way, he says, it is their son, it is there, my daughter, that you have gone wrong or gone astray. And it is as if in the very same breath, remember, the Spirit of God is God's breath. In the same breath he says, now, that's what's wrong. Own it and forsake it and let me forgive you and forget it forever as quickly as possible and resume happy fellowship together. But there's nothing as gentle and kindly as that here. This God is a monster, even as Job describes him. A monster. And we have not the slightest doubt that it is the false God who is breathing down Job's neck and is using these so-called friends to add to his misery. This is Satan, the ruthless, brutal, heartless devil who loves to plunge in the knife into our souls and turn it in the wound with such excruciating pain. He is to be hated of all creatures. The Bible challenges us, charges us, hate evil, and put a D at the beginning of the last word, hate the devil. But poor Job, see his dilemma. Job, dare not hate him, for he is, quote, God. And although he is proving this God, who is tormenting him, is proving to be diametrically opposed to all that he has ever known of the God who has blessed him so richly. There is only one God, and he daren't fall out with him. And if God has changed his color, what can he do? You see, faith, when it is authentic, God-given faith, cannot be downed altogether. There is, after all, Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 17, there is the perseverance of the saints. And so, despite all this, and although Job is worn down so sorely toward the end of that ninth chapter, Job has an insight of faith, as we read, which shows how in the gloom and in the anguish he is beginning to penetrate the darkness which was enveloping him. Look again at 9:32, he is not a man like me that I might answer him, that we might confront each other in court. If only there were someone, isn't that wonderful? Oh, what penetration towards the Christ, the Messiah, the Mediator. If only there were someone to arbitrate between us, to lay his hand upon us both. Someone to remove God's rod from me so that his terror would frighten me no more, he says. That's a man of faith, yearning for a mediator, a day's man, an umpire, as if to say, there should be someone like that. And this word,
which you may translate any way you like, mediator, umpire, daysman, or whatever. This word goes back to Jacob. Jacob bargaining with Laban, Genesis 31 and 37, and you find it in Isaiah chapter 2 and the 4th verse. Let me read a little of that messianic passage. Listen, Isaiah 2 and 2. The mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. You know the paraphrase. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. You see that? They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, O house of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord, for he will judge between the nations and settle disputes for many peoples. An umpire, a mediator. And so we come to chapter 11, and Zophar, the third of the friends, who now speaks in chapter 11. And we have the cruelest of the three here. The cruelest of the three. His contempt for Job knows no bounds. It is astonishing, you see, as you read this chapter, the amount of verbal poison that he belches out. This is a man. This man, Zophar, is a man who knows not the difference between good and evil. Look at what he says at the fourth verse of chapter. You say to God, my beliefs are flawless, and I am pure in your sight. Oh, says he cynically, sarcastically, how I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you, he says. And what he says needs to be compared with what the Lord says about Job. You remember what he says about Job in the last chapter of the book and the 7th verse? Listen, is this what God says about this man that these friends are accusing so sorely? After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. That's God's estimate of this man. He says, Zophar says, God is exacting less from you than you deserve. Imagine anyone speaking to an anguished soul like that. What a hateful creature the devil is when he finds agents willing to spew out his vitriolic suggestions against God's men. But you see, Job replied in chapter 12. Look at chapter 12, the beginning of chapter 12. Doubtless, and he can be sarcastic too. There is such a thing as holy sarcasm. Doubtless, he says, you are the people and wisdom will die with you. But I have a mind as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know all these things that you're blethering to me? And then verse 7, ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds of the air and they will tell you. And then verse 13, to God belong wisdom and power, counsel and understanding are his. And then he goes on in the 13th chapter to say this. My eyes have seen all this.
My ears have heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you, but I desire to speak to the Almighty and to argue my case with God. You, however, smear me with lies. You are worthless physicians, all of you. If only you would be altogether silent. For you, that would be wisdom to shut up. Hear now my argument, says Job. Listen to the plea of my lips. Will you speak wickedly on God's behalf? Will you speak deceitfully for him? Will you show him partiality? Will you argue the case for God? Would it turn out well if he examined you? Could you deceive him as you might deceive men? He would surely rebuke you if you secretly showed partiality. Would not his splendor terrify you? Would not the dread of him fall on you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. Keep silent, my friends, and let me speak, he says. Then let come to me what may. Why do I put myself in jeopardy and take my life in my hands by speaking? And here's the famous verse. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this might turn out for my deliverance. For no godless man would dare come before him. And in this, listen carefully to my words. Let your ears take in what I say. Now that I have prepared my case, I know, he says, that I will be vindicated. Now you see how faith is wonderfully rising there. Then, in chapter 14, he laments the brevity of man's life. And, of course, by the analogy of the reviving sap in the roots of a tree that has been cut down and begins to grow again, by that analogy, he feels after something similar for man to the tree, you see. And it's resurrection he's feeling after, you see. The tree is cut down, but it sprouts again. And then he cries. He cries in chapter 40. Look at the 12th verse of chapter 14. So man lies down and does not rise till the heavens are no more. Men will not awake or be roused from their sleep. And then they see him feeling after. So if only you would hide me in the grave and conceal me till your anger is past. If only you would set me a time and then remember me. If a man dies, will he live again? Notice how he goes on. All the days of my hard service I will wait for my renewal to come. Isn't that great? You will call and I will answer you. You will long for the creature your hands have made. Surely then you will count my steps, but not keep track of my sin. My offenses will be sealed up in a bag. You will cover over my sin, he says. Isn't that wonderful? That's wonderful. Despite the fact that he doesn't know who is afflicting him, he's holding on to the real God, the blessed God, the gracious God, the saving God. That's wonderful. And then, it's Eliphaz's turn again. What will he say this time? He is shocked at Job's wild words. You see, Eliphaz is simply a pious, narrow-minded soul whose God remains millions of miles away and could never be involved in any earthly trouble or sorrow. And so he says, down, little man, admit your wickedness and lie down in the dust. There's no faith there, no faith there in Eliphaz, just a studied, orthodox belief in a God afar off who is simply to be worshipped servilely and must never be asked any questions.
nor must one raise one's eyes above the ground to look at him.
But you see, Job will not be downed. His sufferings are too painful and his faith too lively for that. Look at chapter 16. Marvelous. I have heard many things like these, he says. Miserable comforters are you all. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you that you keep on arguing? I also could speak like you if you were in my place. I could make fine speeches against you and shake my head at you, but my mouth would encourage you. Rather, comfort from my lips would bring you relief. That's the kind of man I am. Yet if I speak, my pain is not relieved, and if I refrain, it does not go away. Then he turns to God. Surely, surely, O God, you have worn me out. You have devastated my entire household. You have bound me. And it has become a witness. My gauntness rises up and testifies against me. God assails me and tears me in his anger and gnashes his teeth at me. My opponent fastens on me his piercing eyes. Men open their mouths to jeer at me. They strike my cheek and scorn and unite together against me. God has turned me over to evil men and thrown me into the clutches of the wicked. He says, all was well with me, but he shattered me. He seized me by the neck and crushed me. He has made me his target. His archers surround me. Without pity, he pierces. This is the devil, although he thinks it's God. Without pity, he pierces my kidneys and spills my gall on the ground. Again and again, he bursts upon me. He rushes at me like a warrior. I have sewed sackcloth over my skin and buried my brow in the dust. Oh, this is moving. My face is red with weeping. Deep shadows ring my eyes. Yet my hands have been free of violence, and my prayer is pure. O earth, do not cover my blood. Think of the blood of Abel. Crying from the ground, O earth, do not cover my blood. May my cry never be laid to rest. Even now, oh, this is wonderful. Look at the faith of this. Look at it penetrating the gloom through the clouds to the sun. Even now, my witness is in heaven. My advocate is on high. My intercessor is my friend. Ah. If my eyes pour out tears to God, on behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads for his friend. Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? I think that's just beyond words. Here's a man who sees right through beyond all Christ's redeeming work on earth, not only to his resurrection, but to his ascension. Where our high priestly intercessor sits at the right hand of the Father, pleading his advocacy of us. He's in heaven, and says, Job, he's my friend. That's tremendous. And then, in the last verses of chapter 16, ah, oh, poor dear man, he suddenly slumps into a kind of despair. You see that? Look at the 22nd verse of 16. Only a few years will pass before I go on the journey of no return. And so he laments, my spirit is broken. See how he vacillates between elation, the elation of faith, and the despair of doubt that Satan brings upon him. My days are cut short, the grave awaits me. Surely mockers surround me. My eyes must dwell on their hostility. Give me, O God, the pledge you demand. Oh, now, here's
Here's the whole Bible gathered together. The ministry of demand in the Old Testament becomes the ministry of supply in the New. Oh, what insight. Give me, O God, the pledge. That's wonderful. You demand. Who else will put up security for me? You have closed their minds to understanding. Therefore, you will not let them triumph. If a man denounces his friends for reward, the eyes of his children will fail, he says. God has made me a byword to everyone, a man in whose face people spit. My eyes have grown dim with grief. My whole frame is but a shadow. Upright men are appalled at this. The innocent are aroused against the ungodly. Nevertheless, the righteous will hold to their ways, and those with clean hands will grow stronger. But come on, all of you, try again. His friends, his so-called friends, I will not find a wise man among you, he says. Not a wise man among you. Then Bildad is back again. It's really a terrible speech to make to a man aching from head to foot with pain and racked with the agonies of his situation, sitting on his own dung heap with not a comforter in the world. And it makes us cry out, at least made me cry out at this point when I was typing, where are you, Mrs. Job? Don't you care at all? Where are you? But listen to what this brute, Bildad, says to the poor man. When will you end these speeches? Be sensible and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as cattle and considered stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself to pieces in your anger, is the earth to be abandoned for your sake? And must the rocks be moved from their place? The lamp of the wicked is snuffed out. The flame of his fire stops burning. The light in his tent becomes dark. The lamp beside him goes out. The vigor of his step is weakened, his own schemes throw him down, his feet thrust him into a net, and he wanders into its mesh. A trap seizes him. Can you conceive of such cruelty? And such wrong-headedness? A trap seizes him by the heel, a snare holds him fast, a noose is hidden for him on the ground, a trap lies in his path. Any kind of hunting not represented there. Terrors startle him on every side and dog his every step. Calamity is hungry for him. Disaster is ready for him when he falls. It eats away parts of his skin. Death's firstborn devours his limbs. He is torn from the security of his tent and marched off to the king of terrors. Fire resides in his tent. Burning sulfur is scattered over his dwelling. His roots dry up below and his branches wither above. The memory of him perishes from the earth. He has no name in the land. He is driven from light into darkness and is banished from the world. He has no offspring or descendants among his people, no survivor where once he lived. Men of the West are appalled at his fate. Men of the East are seized with horror. Surely such is the dwelling of an evil man. Such is the place of one who knows not God. Isn't that awful? Did you ever read the like? Then Job rises. We've come to our last chapter tonight. Then Job rises. His gorge
of righteous indignation burning into his frenzied and his tortured soul, and he lets fly. First at these men, and then at their, quote, God, who is tormenting him so. Look at chapter 19. How long will you torment me and crush me with words? 10 times now you have reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone. Why did you come? If indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me, then know that God still thinks this. God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry, I've been wronged, I get no response. Though I call for help, he says, there is no justice. He has blocked my way so that I cannot pass. He has shrouded my path in darkness. He has stripped me of my honor and removed the crown from my head. He tears me down on every side till I am gone. He uproots my hope like a tree. His anger burns against me. He counts me among his enemies. His troops advance in force. They build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. He has alienated my brothers from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My kinsmen have gone away. My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. I summon my servant, but he does not answer, though I beg him with my own mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers, even the little boy. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped by only the skin of my teeth. And then, you see, he turns back to these friends. And this is what he says. Have pity on me, my friends. Have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? And then, apparently by a supreme effort and with the exercise of that faith which burns so mysteriously in his uncomprehending soul, he utters one of the greatest cries that you'll find in the Bible, which stands with some of the most glorious New Testament words in the whole book, describing and glorying in Christ's resurrection. For he says, oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool, on lead, or engraven in rock forever. You see what he means by that? You engrave the letters on the rock, and you pour molten lead into them, as you find in gravestones. You see, oh, that my words were recorded on a scroll, inscribed with an iron tool and lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes. I, and not another. Isn't that wonderful? And see what has happened. This man, whose God formerly had blessed him with every earthly blessing,
because he could trust him with wealth and prosperity as God trusts few men, so that the wealthier he became, the more compassionate and selfless he became. Read chapters 29 and 31 tonight. This man, driven almost to despair by the sudden ruin of all his life, the loss of his wealth and family, the estrangement of his wife, and these three Job's comforters to rub salt into his many wounds, this man has fought his way through multifarious despairs and has thrashed his way right through to resurrection. This God absolutely against him will not prevent his survival. No. That's terrific, isn't it? He now afflicted him so excruciatingly, so murderously, is not going to get him down. He will yet climb through all the mountains of adversity which have engulfed and overwhelmed.
Of body and mind and soul. Faith can rise like Job's tree cut down to the bare stump, so that it sprouts and grows and at last flourishes like Job's faith flourished in that magnificent cry, "I know that my Redeemer liveth, my Vindicator lives." After all, One of the most promising prophetic predictions in the Old Testament is that which says almost defiantly, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse, from his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes." He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge. With justice he will give decisions. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb, and the leopard lie down with the goat, and the calf and the lion together, and a little child shall lead them. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Isaiah 11. That's faith. That's transcending, soaring faith. So you see, you only need to go over Job's insights of faith in this book thus far that we've looked at tonight to see the invincibility of faith
Chapter 1, verses 21-22. Chapter 2, verse 10. Chapter 7:17, the great words of Psalm 8, which the Hebrew writer takes to exalt Christ as crowned with glory and honor. Chapter 9, verses 32-35, about the need for a mediator, or an umpire, or a daysman. Job's trust in the God he knew, and is holding on to whatever this monster God does to him. Chapter 13:15, though he slay... and hope of resurrection. Words of his, but his witness being in heaven, his advocate on high, and the intercessor being his friend, pleading with God for him. And lastly, this evening, this immense affirmation, which rises like a great volcanic island out of the sea, and defies whole oceans of incriminating falsehood, which would engulf the dear man's soul. Here's a man from the earliest days of the patriarchs, rising from the mire and tearing his way to the surface, and like the Lord himself in Genesis 3:15, exposing the serpent and asserting the enmity of faith of the seed of the woman to crush the tempter's head, and yet with the identity of Satan as yet only half discerned. He is fighting a devil he doesn't yet know. Wield in all his bestial power until chapters 40 and 41. But Job shouts his defiance of faith to high heaven and stakes his all on the fact that he is not the awful sinner these three rascals have said. But he is the upright man of integrity God says he is, despite all that the Almighty has allowed Satan to do to him. Now, we are not saying that it was not necessary for Job to go through this fiery trial. It was obviously in the will of God. But he would have come through it with flying colors, waving far more gloriously if... For of course, you see, the Lord did tick him off kindly and humiliatingly toward the end. He would have come through with flying colors even more gloriously, I'm saying, if he had known from the beginning that it was Satan who was afflicting him, even if it was at the behest of his own God who loved him. For he would have held to his God against that interloper, and would have had his God's encouragement to endure all the more. Jesus knew who his enemy was in Gethsemane and on the cross, and he knew that his Father was stronger than all the cohorts of hell and would strengthen him.